This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
You know, in some people's eyes, you would think I was designed to fail, but I wasn't being trained to win. I was being trained for what my life would look like, right? Which is a constant act of resilience in this world.
Welcome to the Color of Money podcast. We have an amazing episode for you today, and I am joined by my phenomenal co-host, Julia Lachey, Daniel Dixon, and the one and only Imric Peace. Today, we are joined by Angel Bruner. Angel Bruner is the founder and CEO of EB5 Capital, which is an organization that she grew into a $100+ billion commercial real estate investment firm with over 30 projects across all real estate investment classes. Her company has served over 1,900 clients from 75 countries and created more than 35,000 jobs here in the U.S. Over her career, she's been active in the capital markets, in real estate investing, in the funding of early stage companies. She's an active global angel investor and advises across a number of different industries. She's a member of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, REIS, and the Urban Land Institute. What Angel brings, though, has been a real interesting view towards seeing the world the way it is, to being deeply connected to people, but also to the future and where things are going. She's more recently brought her extensive experience into the boardrooms of large public companies, serving on the boards of the Chesapeake Lodging and Trust, on the global board of Cushman Wakefield, and most recently, she is a board member of the CoStar Group, which we are all very familiar here with in the real estate industry. So welcome, Angel.
Great to be here, Bo.
Great to have you with us. And, you know, I think always when we start off, you've got all these accolades, all this story, but, you know, fundamentally, I think it's always great for our listeners to get to know you as a person. And so maybe you can just tell us a little bit about who Angel is and how you came to be before you were the Mrs. Bruner we know today.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for inviting me to tell my story. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm primarily a change maker and a shapeshifter is what I would say. I'm a problem solver. And I learned early on that sometimes when you're solving problems, you're not always finding solutions. You're more often creating them. And once you untether yourself from the search process of looking for a solution and you instead embrace the idea that you actually have to create a solution, it almost becomes easier because you're not looking for answers anymore. You know that you're the master of creating the solution and solving the problem.
How did you develop that mindset? That mindset, you know, came from somewhere, and how is it applied?
So early in life, I got to train not for winning, but for resilience. Martial arts was my first sport, and my first sensei would only let me spar boys and men as a young girl, and I couldn't understand why. And he invited me to teach, but I still couldn't get a black belt because I had to get an A on exams, and I couldn't get an A fighting boys and men. And so I learned a muscle memory for bravery that I didn't know I was learning. And so it gave me a lot of patience later in life for everything that I would have to do in business. What I realized was it taught me not to quit. And so I learned, and you don't always know what you're learning when you're a kid. You most often don't. But later in life, when I had to think back to, well, why is it that I don't quit? Or why is it that I feel like the people I'm competing with do? And it was because I think I learned young that quitting's not part of my option set. So that resilience was taught early. And I think resilience is probably one of the most important factors to success. And I think quitting is probably the surest way to fail. And since I wasn't allowed to quit, I often don't quit when everyone else does. And that will usually get me to some place of success.
You know, just piggybacking on Bo's question about mindset, being that you've built these big businesses, you've led these major projects, and you sit on these powerful boards, martial arts, I didn't, that's pretty impressive that that's how you kind of got that mindset. But I was wondering if there were daily habits that you use to help you stay focused and keep that confidence on your journey, especially when I'd imagine that there are doors that aren't always open for you.
There are no doors that are open. I've never been invited into a room. I didn't start getting invited into a room until I got invited on boards. And when I got on my first board, I don't want to name names, but they changed the voting so that you could take all five votes and vote for one person. And they thought that that would mean that it would weight the votes against me for other people, because they really just wanted to vote for the same people they'd been voting for. And so if they gave people five votes that they could vote for one person, that they that there was no way in their minds I would get those votes. And it ended up with me getting more votes than anyone had ever gotten in history because they weighted the process. And then it was weighted towards me. So I don't think success doesn't allow you to wait. And you can't wait for an invitation. You can't wait for someone to understand what you're doing. Your confidence has to come from the person in the mirror. And that has to be what you build on. You can't expect to get people to understand what you're doing. And that's a key component of leadership. Sometimes people think leadership comes from a team, but leadership can come alone, and then the team comes. The team gets built from leadership.
It's interesting that you said it that way, Angel Emmerich, because it may not be that it may not be the external team. It may be the internal team. All the things that it took you to get to where you were, that's your team. That's your team. And sometimes you have to go into that place
as a
leader. That's
really well said.
That's the deal. And that's what I heard you say. I had to go inside because outside wasn't really the best option.
Yeah, outside, beyond my sensei, I've had very few people step in and believe in me. And no external belief has matched my capabilities. The only place that I know where what I'm capable of is inside. I am so far beyond anyone's imagination that if I needed people to see me, I don't know where I would be.
Uh-oh. See, Angel, see, you just struck a chord with Julia. I saw that girl's smile come out. Yeah, girl, tell him, girl. Yeah. I heard you. Yeah. I saw it, Julia.
I got a follow-up there, though. If we, like, the internal belief has been incredibly strong, but with the business that you've built, you're raising money with people who have to believe in you. So how do you bridge that gap?
Oh, it's worse than that. Yeah, it's worse than that. So let's just be practical for a second. I have a deadly peanut allergy, and I have been to the emergency room in all top five countries that I fundraise in. I have been in near-death situations in every single country I've had to go to.
Wow.
And I mean from getting a $1 cup of noodles at the gift shop at the Great Wall outside of Beijing to, you know, grabbing a handful of something from the bar at my hotel. And if I didn't have the spiritual foundation I have, I probably picked the hardest thing I could possibly do. I have them challenged with languages. I'm physically at risk of death. And I'm going into countries, all of which don't provide for my human rights as a gay person. Mm-hmm. So who says, oh, that must be what I'm supposed to do? That must be the path that I'm supposed to take to deal with these food deserts and to deal with what our capital markets have failed to do. That must be the right path. Your belief and your energy emanates from inside you. So I don't sell myself. I just be myself. And myself is a person without self-doubt. myself as a person who, whatever I'm doing, I believe that I'm born for it.
So two things that I want to, one, I want to make sure that we give our listeners a little foundation in what your business actually is. So I don't know, Angel, if you could take a second to describe.
Sure.
Maybe first how you came to start the business and what the business actually does and how EB5 works.
First off, I want to say that my business is just the assembly of my values. It's just the complete manifestation of my values in all aspects. So I believe in a connected world. I believe in a diverse world. I believe in an abundant world, and I believe in a limitless world. And my business reflects those values. So I live in Washington, D.C., which was a food desert when I moved here in 99. And I was given the reason that it was a food desert was because of the Martin Luther King riots. So that weighed on me morally, that we were in 2000 and capable people were telling me that they had an intractable problem with no solutions, that it existed since 1968. That didn't sit well with me. It didn't sit, it wasn't a story that I wanted to participate in. So I ended up leaving venture capital, going to Fannie Mae, going to NCRC for the local listeners, National Capital Revitalization, all in an attempt to institutionally address the food deserts. I was fired twice for working too fast. First, I was called in and told my pace was upsetting people. And what I thought was, well, everyone's pace is upsetting me. Then I went to a larger shop and I got pulled in again. And I got a lecture on the pace at which you should turn a battleship. Then I had to leave that opportunity. And I actually ended up choosing to be, I chose to be homeless, actually, to start this business. I could only pay for one rent, and I was helping to support my brother. And so between his rent and my mortgage, one of them had to go, and I could work and he couldn't. So it was me that went. And again, everything came from the inside. Beau's a very smart, capable, successful man, and he fessed up at the beginning of the podcast that he didn't understand what I was doing. So I had that belief, and then I found the EB5 program. And so I matched up the desire of people to come to the United States who believe in the American dream, who have to leave their home countries, which is a very vulnerable place to be. And I took our capital needs of funding grocery stores, grocery anchored retail, all of these things. And I'm a trained economist and urban planner, but I didn't think I would be using those skills. And lo and behold, I am. And those foreign investors have to invest a certain amount of money and they have to create jobs. And so I took that job creation requirement and I married it up with grocery stores. And the numbers looked really good. And just like you would do a land appraisal, I would do a job appraisal. And the job appraisals looked like I could raise millions for these projects. And if you recall, back in the early 2000s, it was very difficult for the capital markets to write a check to Washington. They really didn't want to do it. They found a lot of reasons to not underwrite our projects. And so, and any entrepreneur listening will understand, to me, it seemed like the perfect match because I could take all the risk. I could take the risk of underwriting. I could take the risk of protecting investor capital. I could take the risk of telling the developers that I would raise the money. And I could put a project together if I was willing to take all the risk. And that's what you do as an entrepreneur, is you take all the risk. And again, I think I had the privilege of having that be part of my muscle memory from the extreme practice that I had of martial arts that was, you know, in some people's eyes, you would think I was designed to fail, but I wasn't being trained to win. I was being trained for what my life would look like, right? Which is a constant act of resilience in this world. And so I was taught to have stamina for that. And I have a limitless amount of stamina for that.
So Angel, fundamentally, what your business does is help find projects in the United States, which start out in Washington, D.C., that meet the criteria of producing jobs and need capital. And then you go and raise money from investors in other countries who are looking to get visas through the EB-5 program, where they're able to invest money into projects that create jobs. And when those projects deliver those jobs and they invest that money, they're able to get to come to get access to come to the United States through that visa. Is that adequate?
So, and we have been overwhelmingly successful in that. We have helped over 2,000 families from over 75 countries realize their American dream. And we've created over 50,000 jobs to date in more than 15 states. And we're licensed in the lower 48. We can do anything from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean.
I've got a question about that, Angel. Given the current climate, with all of the deportations and all of those things, what is your world looking like right now? You talked about having to have resilience. I'd imagine that's a daily thing you carry around doing a job like this. Given the current climate, how does that shape your daily experience?
Honestly, I think resilience is the, if I had to give up any skills or any talents, that is the one that I would want to keep. I can hire everything else, right? I can build everything else. But really, I've noticed that it's my resilience that helps my team on a day-to-day basis. And I can gift it. I can gift it to everyone on my team. And that's the point of leadership, is you can actually gift your gifts to the entire team. And they can stand on your strengths. And they also fall on your weaknesses. I'm sure we've all been on teams that weren't that strong. And I imagine those teams didn't have great leadership. So in this climate, we are still facing overwhelming demand because a lot of what we're addressing as a country is shifting centers of power in the world. And for the people who want to remain living in a democracy or a quasi-democracy, we remain a very popular choice. And we're the strongest choice if you're an entrepreneur. And the majority of our clients are entrepreneurs, people who literally are creating their own success. And so I would say we're still one of the top choices for entrepreneurs because we, for the most part, on the local level, have retained the rule of law and doing business is relatively straightforward and safe.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit hometeam.com to learn more.
Like, I'm listening to this and I'm like, this is really neat. This is like way, like you said, futuristic, outside of the box, because in order for you to get to this place, you had to start somewhere. So what was the real impetus behind you putting this together? Because I'm sitting here like, I heard her say futuristic, but this is like way out of the box futuristic.
That's right. Remember I talked earlier about creation. You need to untether yourself from the act of finding and tether yourself to the act of creation. So I needed a source of capital to deal with the cap in the capital stack in urban projects. That's what I needed. And I did not need it to exist. I needed to get the money. And so you have a group here that is required by law to create jobs. And American jobs are very expensive. Their investment initially was only $500,000. You cannot create an American job with $500,000 of investment. You certainly can't create 10 jobs with $500,000 of investment. So you have to pool the money. And because of the delayed efforts to rebuild cities after the Martin Luther King riots, that is true of not just Washington, but many cities, there was an opportunity to fund many projects that just by the laws of supply and demand would work. Washington, D.C., when I started, had a $5 billion of retail bleed. Retail bleed is when I drive someplace else to do shopping. So if I could just bring some of that commercial opportunity back into the district, I was economically guaranteed success from a supply and demand. This is just very, you know, just keeping it simple, right? So as an urban planner and an economist, I knew that. I knew those things were given to me. And so I think we've all met a lot of bankers, and there are not a lot of bankers that are urban planners and or economists. And so I had a perspective that I could bring to the puzzle that was probably a little bit more advanced academically than the folks that had been trying to create a solution, or worse, not trying to create a solution, trying to use something that was already on the shelf, right? Okay. And I think what you're hearing, Emmerich, was that I used something that wasn't on the shelf. And that was how we got to now. The other issue is I grew up in Silicon Valley. So my idea of a normal world is probably closer to the Star Wars cantina than some other examples of diversity.
Right.
So to me, that's a normal world. And I was moving back east and moving more south. I was a little surprised by how little diversity actually exists. And so I felt very privileged that I was able to find a solution that was going to add to the diversity that I wanted to normalize.
Andrew, can I ask you some questions about leadership? You said some things that really stood out to me. You said you can gift your gifts. And so like your team, they can stand on your strengths. 100%. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, as a woman who's led in spaces where representation is super limited, what gifts maybe could you share with us, agents that are listening, entrepreneurs that are listening? What gifts could you share with us, or people who are trying to kind of grow their leadership or grow their influence and lead with, I suppose, purpose, like you are?
Well, I was gifted leadership at a young age, right? My sensei pulled me out as a child to help him teach class where I was teaching men and all kinds of stuff. And then, you know, I've been captain or MVP or coach of all my teams or all of the above. I still have a strong relationship with USA Rugby. And during COVID, I had the opportunity to mentor Olympic athletes. So I had a strong path of leadership and an understanding of the power of leadership before I ever got to the business world. And, you know, for those parents that are listening, give your children opportunity to lead. Give your children opportunity to teach them that failure is part of success, that it's just part of the iteration, that anything exists in the built world is the result of thousands of failed experiments, and to embrace that as a learning path and not be afraid of it, to really sort of run towards that iterative learning. In terms of leadership, I have never had the privilege until now to be in a room where the cavalry might be coming. I have only ever been the only in a room, and I've only ever been uninvited. So it's only in, I would say, the last 10 years of my career that I've ever been invited into a room. And I'm invited into the room with the board. For example, my chancellor, Brown, is the CEO of Bank of America. My chairman of the board at CoStar is the chancellor at Princeton. I'm in the room with incredible leaders now as my peers, and it feels good. It feels good. I found that, and I most recently, now what I would tell you is I was recently at a meeting of Black Women on Boards, which just started to exist during COVID. And there are a number of women in that group that have written books that have already been published. Ken Chenault came to speak with us this past week at our meeting in Chicago. There's a common theme, at least among African-American women or women of African descent. And for me, I find that resilience runs in our DNA. So I think if you're going to teach leaders, then you would want to give them opportunities to be resilient. What's it like to be a team captain on a losing team? You know, there are lots of ways to teach children resilience. Communication skills. You have to be generous. You have to have an abundance mindset. You know, in order for me to gift my gifts, I have to believe they're limitless, right? That whatever I give to you doesn't take from me. You can have as much of what I have as you want. So I think an abundance mindset is critical. Can't have a scarcity mindset. You have to look for the opportunities and the failures. Don't waste a crisis. All of those principles ring true when you're building something or leading something. And your confidence is the most important thing. And true confidence has no, you know, arrogance isn't part of it. People can sense the difference between confidence and arrogance. Confidence is very quiet, doesn't need to speak, doesn't need credit.
I want to go back to something Daniel asked a while ago and maybe tease it out a little bit. So you've talked a lot about confidence and composure in your own identity, yet much of your success in life has been about connection with others. And so how do you think about how being comfortable in your own skin or true to who you are enables you to connect and engage with others versus I know for me and a lot of our listeners, I think sometimes we think that if we are who we are, if people see us for who we are, then that's like a definite exclusion from the room. It's a definite exclusion from the relationship. Yet you have walked into some of the most exclusive places.
Yes.
Trumping who you are, but it seems kind of, it can't just be like, I am who I am. Because if I just am who I am and I'm dogmatic about who I am, I don't connect with anybody else who's not like me. So there's something else going on beyond just angel.
Sure.
How does that work?
Sure. Let me address that in two ways. You guys are all too young to know this, but I've always had a finance career. And early in my finance career, I was forced to conform. I was forced to wear heels and skirts, and I couldn't even wear what I wanted on the weekends. I remember seeing a Wall Street boss on the weekend when I was walking in New York with my girlfriend and I was in jeans. Maybe they were a little baggy. And I remember thinking in that moment that I lost that job. And so I haven't always been myself, and it hasn't always been comfortable. And I found that it was so uncomfortable to be someone else that I wasn't really going to be able to thrive unless I was willing to be myself. So that's one. Because I needed to be in command of my full confidence and capabilities. That's one. And two, I would say that, the United States is the only country I'm possible in. And I don't have to say that, because when I walk into the room in any other country, in any other place, they have never seen anything like me. And it's because I'm not possible in that space. And the possibility of me in the United States and the actuality of me reinforces the myths that they believe, right? In a positive way. So they believe you come to the United States, you work hard, you can do anything. Because that's true for me, it's true for them. Because they are less controversial than me, right? They are more accepted than me. I am the least accepted commodity in the world. So in order for me to be successful, one of the things I trade on is trust. And the thing you see with me immediately is my honesty. Because if I wasn't honest, then why would I present like this, right? Why would I give myself all these problems? Why would I present myself as an outlier? So that confidence and trust is what I lead with. And that's what people see. And I never even have to say it, because in expressing myself, I express my integrity.
Angel, how do you, this is a somewhat vulnerable question. So if it's too far, please let me know. But in this world of DEI being a thing, and then now this new administration, DEI not being a thing, and I'm sure some of the boardrooms that you're in, people don't think you belong, and people think maybe you just got appointed because of the outlier that you are. How do you handle that? Like, I sense that you don't go fight every battle, but like, how do you process and deal with that?
Actually, it's only the people who aren't in the room who think that. I am not a good token. You would never choose me. I am not your checkbox. you can get a much easier going wallflower if you're looking for a checkbox. I'm not actually even available to you. So it's never the case for me. For example, on my first board, I was recommended. So here's a good example. So if you talk to some of the DEI recruiters and you ask them, okay, you've got a board, it's got six people on it. Let's say it's got eight people. Let's be generous, including the chairman. And it already has a black person on it. Let's say it even already has a black woman on it. Oh, wow. Okay. Would you actually look at another black woman to join that board? That is where you find your unconscious bias. You oftentimes those recruiters will tell you, oh my God, no, they already have a black woman. Why would I waste another black woman's time talking to them about that board?
Yeah.
Now, let me tell you my experience. My first board, there were only five people on it. And I was the addition. I was the first female and I was the second black gay person. So you tell me that room had anything to do with DEI. What would you need two black gay people for in a room of five people? Now, fast forward to my third board. I'm also on the board with another black gay person. Ask me what my CEOs were in all those cases. They were all white men. So I don't have any issues with diversity in the rooms that I'm in. People choose me for me. Where I get the unconscious bias is in the, I'm so happy you asked that question, Daniel, because that is the experience of people outside the room. The people who are inside the room, no one thinks I'm in that room for the color of my skin or my gender or my sexuality. And so I don't experience any of it. And I, you know, and to my situation, I don't talk to recruiters because unless you know me, you don't actually know what you're looking for. So it's only from outside the room and it's only from other people of color for the most part.
So what you're saying to us, what you're saying to us and our listeners, our audience is that I hear be yourself. You're your own unique commodity and walk in the skin that you're in.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. And I'm a spiritual person, so I would never, I would never want to waste my gifts. That to me seems disrespectful. And so that's an issue. And then I want to highlight that path because people have to understand that as people of color and minorities, a lot of times the unconscious bias they're facing is coming from themselves. It's coming from themselves. It's their limits, right? A lot of people wouldn't even look at a board that already had a black person on it or, oh my God, a black gay person. How would a company of stature ever have two black gay people on the board? Well, maybe their color and their sexuality has nothing to do with their skills.
Can you explain the board process, like a being on a board and like why? Just I'm trying to make sure that we also, because you've touched on so many things in a leadership standpoint, like also like we haven't had anybody on here really has, you know, you part of your professional career has been serving on the boards of large public companies. And so can you speak a little bit about that?
So the board is a collection of people who have skills that are not present inside the company that the CEO hand selects as advisors to the leadership and success of the company. That is what a board is. So if you are at a point in your career where you are so confident in your skills that you want, that you believe that you can help someone else run a company that's larger than yours, then you're ready for board service. If you do not have that internal confidence in your skills, then you're not ready for a board. I always say my first love was data and, or my first love is data. And I'm a very process driven person. I build scalable things. I build culture. I build leadership. I build confidence in teams. Like my whole team, I meet 1% of my clients. I meet 1% of my clients because my clients can get a sense of the values. And I'm a values-based leader. Rules are for the absence of values. So I can push down a a lot of responsibility very low into my company because anyone can check in with the values of the company and figure out what the decision is to make. So I have global experience. I have a lot of experience. I have domain experience in hotels. I have domain experience in different investment environments, different asset classes. So, but a lot of times when you're on a board, you're in an industry that you don't know. A lot of my friends chair boards that are outside their domain expertise because mainly at the board level, you are recognized for problem solving and leadership. So those are really the skills that a CEO, you know, you're basically the kitchen cabinet for the CEO. You're who the CEO turns to solve problems, to scale, to vision the future. So they, you know, they need people who are unbridled. I always say goals are the fence around your yard. Goals are the limits of your imagination. Everyone should strive to be beyond their imagination at all times. Goals should be what you step to, but you have to be willing to step past them because goals are only the limit of your imagination.
Angel, I have one final question for you, but I'd like to say something before I ask the question because you're so powerful. I'll let your words be our final thing that the listeners hear. But I first want to just thank you for being here. You've said so many things that the benefit I get of being a co-host on this podcast is that it's fulfilling and edifying for myself, if for no one else. But you said so many things. Just I appreciate you showing up so unapologetically you know, and talking about the confidence. I often feel like I have to get in a room and immediately read my resume in order to justify why I'm there. You're saying the exact opposite thing, you know, and so I appreciate you saying confidence is quiet. You trust in yourself. You believe in yourself. So for me, this has been incredibly powerful. So my last question I want to ask you is for the rest of our listeners, what's the one thing that you want people who were listening to this episode to take away from the conversation that we've been blessed to have with you?
So in martial arts, as a small person, in order to win, I actually have to use someone else's weight against them. And so in business, how that translates is I use other people's unconscious bias to my advantage. So I walk into a room and you either don't notice me because of whatever you're thinking, you disregard me because whatever you're thinking, or you discount me because of whatever you're thinking. The idea that you might think, oh my gosh, I have to know what she's thinking, has never happened to me. And I could keep waiting for that if I ever did. So I use that quiet space of disregard as a strength. And I am, by the time I'm beating you, that's the first time you notice I've been in the room, is when you're number two. And I just let it be that way. I don't need anyone else to notice me. And my name comes into a room before I come into a room in these board situations. I've never been recruited. I don't work with recruiters. I let my name come out of someone else's mouth when someone asks someone else for advice. You know, who should I talk to? I need this, this, and this. Oh, you should talk to Angel. Okay, great. Then my phone rings. Do I know about that company beforehand? No, I don't. I didn't know Cushman was, you know, wanted me until the CEO called. So I would say that. And then the second thing I would say is, so use other people's biases to your advantage. Do that. And that I would take notice of the voices. You know, what is your self-talk? And if you have negative self-talk, work on that. Don't work on, you know, work on the imposter syndrome. Don't be bothered with what people notice on the outside. Make sure that you've got your team in order on the inside.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for being here with us. We're glad you were able to join us from wherever it is you are in the world. Daniel, Bo, Emmerich, any final words before we wrap up here?
No, thank you. I think we talked once before about this power. The power that being authentic provides us in the ability to connect, and that sometimes it's that authenticity that drives connection. And I think that's one of my big takeaways from today. So just very grateful for the episode. Hope that everyone has a great day.
Thank you, Bo. Thank you, Emmerich. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Julia. This has been terrific. I really appreciated the questions, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share some of my strengths and hopefully help some other people use theirs.
Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.